from KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. When Katie Hafner's 77-year-old mother moved in, the San Francisco writer suddenly found herself living with her ailing mom and her teenage daughter. Hafner's new memoir, Mother, Daughter, Me, tells the story of her tumultuous childhood relationship with her mom and her hopes for being able to create a new, better family dynamic at this later stage of life. As it turned out, family baggage is hard to lose, all the more difficult with three generations living under one roof. Stay with us for a conversation with Katie Hafner on Forum, coming your way after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in today for Michael Krasny. The sandwich generation is a term that often refers to those helping take care of aging parents while also in the midst of raising their own kids. Both ends of the spectrum may need and want attention from the sandwiched one, but at the same time resent or resist the notion that they need a caretaker. For the person in the middle, it can be emotionally exhausting and time-wise a difficult balancing act. That said, millions of men and women are doing it right now. Journalist and author Katie Hafner has been there. In her memoir, Mother, Daughter, Me, she chronicles her experience on this tightrope, but with complicated family baggage as part of the mix, because her mother didn't really raise her. An alcoholic who uprooted Hafner and her sister often, her mother lost custody of her daughter when Hafner was 10. So while she had hoped bringing her now 77-year-old mother into her home would pave the way for a new and maybe better sense of family, instead old wounds resurfaced, long-buried baggage was uncovered, and all three of the generations struggled with the legacy of the family story. Mother, Daughter, Me tells the story of Katie Hafner smack in the middle of the sandwich. And this hour we'll talk about her experience as well as ways we can and perhaps cannot recreate a family. Katie Hafner, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Penny.
Well, I want to start by having you read a bit from early on in the book. And I will set it up just briefly. This is your mother has moved in with you now from Southern California. You live in San Francisco. You've even gotten a new home to accommodate her move. And it's been a little bumpy. And so you have sought the help of a counselor and your mom and you have just left the counseling office. And that's where you are now walking into a grocery store.
When we get there, she suggests we take a single cart to avoid redundancies but divide our groceries, my items on one side, hers on the other. Then she says, we'll make it work. At first, I think she's referring to the divided grocery cart, but then I realize she means something else, and I'm not so sure I agree with her. If she's not going to give therapy an honest try, and she seems to distrust Leah already, that's surely going to make things harder. In no mood to be agreeable, I watch her struggle with her good hand to retrieve a half gallon of Lactaid from a high shelf. Pretending I haven't noticed, I turn my back and, cruelly, offer no help. When we get home, my mother pulls from her bag a receipt for something I had asked her to buy for me a few days earlier. "You owe me $10," she says. "You owe me a childhood," I think. And with that, I realized that perhaps I should have sought help before creating this situation. For years, whenever I told people about my childhood, but assured them that my mother and I were now close, that I held no anger, they would ask, "How can you be so forgiving?" I always responded with this: "You can spend your life carrying hurt and anger toward a parent, or you can get over it and move on." All that time, I had thought I resided safely in the latter category, but now I'm seeing that I'm still in the former. I'm not over it, not one little bit.
That's Katie Hafner reading from her memoir, Mother, Daughter, Me. That's very powerful. That's very powerful. Lay the groundwork a little bit. You so wanted this to work. You wanted to rebuild and reconnect right. in a certain way. Lay the groundwork for how you ended up losing your mom initially.
Well, yeah. I was born in Rochester, New York. And when I was five and my sister was seven, my mother announced one day that we were leaving. She had gotten a quickie divorce in Mexico and come home to announce that she was taking my sister and me to Florida, which she did with the promise that there would be oranges everywhere. She said, you can pick them off the trees. And I'm thinking, oranges, Florida's, well, you know, what is this? It had completely upended my world as kids, you know, when you're 5 years old and that suddenly happens, it really throws you for a loop. So she took us to Florida and that, you know, it was a very, very much an anywhere but here kind of thing. Alcoholics, which she was, do this thing called pulling a geographic where you think if you can just get out of this place, another place will be better. So she took us to California, to San Diego, and she was and is.
After Florida. So you after do the Florida move.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah, right. And Florida happened.
Florida happens.
That was about a year and a half. I was in three different first grades. And then took us to California in 1965. So we're going all the way back to the early mid-60s. And then we ended up living first in La Jolla and then in Del Mar. And when I was 10, and the drinking would get better and then it would get worse. And
as a little kid, were you even aware of the drinking at that
yeah.
stage?
Oh, very acutely aware of it. Much more aware of it in San Diego than in Florida. And we knew what would trigger and were scared of whatever would trigger a drinking bout. And yet, you know, when she was sober, she was the world's best mother. I mean, so attentive, so wonderful. And I really, you know, think drinking was really what got in the way of our having a childhood. So anyway, we found her pretty much unconscious one morning, my sister and I. And so we were basically airlifted out of there sent from San Diego to Rochester, back to Rochester. And then we ended up on this whole new odyssey with my father and stepmother and her kids. So my mother didn't raise us. And
at that point, you're 10.
I was 10. And then, but we stayed in touch over the years. We talked a lot on the phone. I went to UCSD. I saw a lot of her. And continue to love her. And as kids of alcoholics often do, and or any child, really, I yearned for her. And I yearned for a real family life with her. So spin forward to 2009, and she went into a crisis in San Diego. She had long since stopped drinking. That happened in 1989, but it was sort of a health living crisis. And so I thought, oh, now's our chance. Now's our chance to have a real family. My husband had died nearly 10 years earlier. My daughter, who was then 15, almost 16, and I were very close. But she too, my daughter also, you thought this would be great, a grandmother nearby. Oh, great, grandparents' day at school. And I think my mother, too, and my daughter, to a certain extent, held this sort of magical fairy tale, gauzy-like view of what we could be doing, like skipping through the daisies.
Well, and because she was now sober and you'd never had a childhood with a mother in any real sense, so you could imagine it any way you wanted to. What were you reimagining as this new family? You were trying to create this family.
Yeah, just your typical kind of Jack and Jill, ordinary childhood. You know, I had that apron fantasy, which I found out a lot of kids have, which is, you know, you picture your mother as this mother with the apron, not a full apron, a half apron with a ruffle, greeting you at the door with chocolate chip cookies. I had that most intensely when I was in about third or fourth grade. And of course, you know, no. I learned later that, you know, Anne Sexton's kids had that same fantasy.
Sure.
So a lot of kids have that fantasy because those mothers are very few and far between, mostly dating back from the 50s when we were reading those books. So that's what I thought it would be, sort of a, not that literally, but a modified version of this really loving, warm, nuclear household that we didn't have.
And how much did your daughter know before your mom moved in, shortly before your mom moved in, how much did your daughter know about the reality of your childhood relationship with your mom?
She knew everything, which comes up later in the book about how much my daughter knew. And I told my daughter about it mostly so that she would know how much alcoholism there was in the family, because I worried a lot. There's alcoholism on both sides of the family, and I felt like she was kind of dodging raindrops because of the genetic component. And I really wanted to drum into her how serious this was, especially as she was entering high school.
Because one of the things about the book that is so powerful and resonates, and I'm sure would resonate with so many different people who find themselves in this situation, is you're working out this whole dynamic, this whole new relationship or construct with this very primal person in your life, your mother. But at the same time, you're the mother to a teenager, which everybody knows is has its own changing dynamic. And the pins and needles effect, you can really feel throughout the book that you're on pins and needles, not wanting to upset the apple cart. Mm. You're trying to cater to your mom, but you're trying to cater to your daughter, conflicting needs, desires, competing for attention. And you are there in the middle, kind of literally it's the Caucasian chalk circle. You're torn.
Oh, yeah, that's such a good analogy. Yeah, I was torn, but, you know, let's not forget, I put myself into that situation because of my optimistic thinking, which I have always been an optimist. And a lot of friends who were much more realistic would say, what are you thinking? But I had this one friend who was living in Beijing at the time, and she said, oh, how Chinese of you to bring your mother in, and the Chinese revere their elderly. And I was thinking, yeah, right. And my mother was buying into this too. She said, what have the Chinese got on us? But then as the everyday reality sunk in, it was gruesome. In fact, I wasn't planning to write a book. It was pretty accidental. Going along doing my work. A book had come out a few years earlier. I wasn't really thinking that much about a new book. And this scene that I read happened. We were in Trader Joe's. And when I turned my back on her and didn't help her get that lactaid down from the shelf, I thought, oh my, this is bad. It was a cruel streak that was in me that I didn't even know I possessed. So I started to write.
And you refer throughout to this as an experiment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think either of us thought we were in this for the long term. We were referring to it as our year in Provence, which actually...
So, which it didn't quite turn out to be.
Well, definitely not a year and definitely not Provence.
But I think it's interesting you found a cruel streak in you, which isn't maybe so much a cruel streak as harkening back to whatever, you know, that child angst. But you also found the cruel streak in your mom. You might have been idealizing quite a bit as we reflect and want and reimagine and recreate. And when mom came to move in, maybe she wasn't drinking, but she was pretty complicated.
She is complicated. I don't think she's not a cruel person by any stretch. I think she has trouble keeping her opinions to herself, which a lot of people do find about their mothers. And when you're living with it 24/7, then it's like, oh dear, this is why people say, oh, I can go, you know, visit my mother for 48 hours and that's it.
And you're already on the tightrope with a teenager.
And I've got this teenager who had lost her dad very suddenly when she was 8 years old. And was still at age 15 having a rough time with abandonment issues. And
so what was the reaction after you had dealt with, basically abandonment yourself, when your mom was not the mom you wanted, the grandmother you wanted to see her be to your daughter? So I'm sure there was a fair amount of expectation that you had about what this relationship between your daughter and your mother would be, which I can imagine would be the case for any of us who are in this situation. We would play out this relationship that was going to be strong and lasting, and your daughter would forever hold it in her mind. And when it wasn't panning out that way, did panic set in for you? Were you remembering?
Just really severe disappointment. And also, but then this kind of crazed determination to make them get along. Like on my birthday, I said, all I want is a gift from the two of you. I don't care if it's a tube of toothpaste, just from the two of you. And of course, they didn't do it because they knew better than I did that it wasn't working. And by that time, this was 4 months into the experiment. they were smarter than I was. They knew it wasn't going to work. And so I had to have that optimist in me sort of shaken loose. And I had this image of someone, you know, tipping me upside down and shaking it out through my head or down through my ears or whatever it took to make me realize that this wasn't going to work. And it's not because either of them, you know, neither of them is a terrible person. It just, Zoe, my daughter, was going through that typical teenage, the full complement of teenage dramas. And that's just what's happening. And for my mother to come in to this, and also she and I, Zoe and I, after my husband died, we were really close. And, you know, a lot of mothers would envy us, our closeness. And I would think, oh, no, you don't want to go through what we went through to get this close by any stretch. But we were unusually close. And I think that I gave short shrift to that, too, when I was thinking about bringing my mother in.
Relay the story about the cello, your mom's comment about the cello that your daughter has spent years and years and years playing and practicing. And then in walks the grandmother, and relay the story.
Well, as
I think it's a nutshell.
Yeah, as the story goes, I was leaving for dinner. Well, my mother had cornered me earlier in the day to say, and Zoe had been playing the cello from the age of five. And my mother is also a musician. She plays the piano, where I should point out to any the 0.001% of people listening who might not know, you don't have to tune a piano except get a professional tuner, but you do always have to tune your cello and learn to play in tune, which you don't have to do with a piano. So my mother had heard Zoe practicing, and Zoe's a very shy player and practices very, very, very reluctantly in front of others. And my mother had heard her playing and said, I think Zoe is a fine technician, which in fact she is, but her intonation, meaning her ability to play in tune, isn't what it could be. She should switch to the piano. And I think, no, let's just cut this off right now. I said, you know, Mom, Zoe and my music is Zoe and – I mean, Zoe's music is Zoe and my thing. And it's Zoe's music. And she and I work on this together, and we have for years, especially since her dad died. And so I thought she would let it rest. I go out to dinner. I come back. I'm asleep in the middle of the night. Zoe taps me on the back. She's crying. And she says, Grandma Susie says I can't play in tune. She says I should not play the cello. I should play the piano. And I just said, what? I was furious.
And this was right before an audition.
This was the day before an audition at the San Francisco Conservatory. I mean, however, I have to say, Penny, I can't blame my mother for that. I mean, Zoe played... She played, she auditioned, she didn't make it in. However, she was a little spooked.
It's more the emotional intrusion is what I'm thinking about
your
family.
Yeah, it was a huge intrusion. And yet, you know, I knew my mother had trouble keeping her opinions to herself. So it gets back to that question of, you know, how sort of misguided it was to have her move in with us.
That's Katie Hafner, and she's the author of a new memoir called Mother, Daughter, Me. And she's also the author of some other books, one called A Romance on Three Legs, Glenn Gould's Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Piano, and also a book called Where Wizards Stay Up Late about the history of the Internet. And this new memoir is very personal and a bit heartbreaking, but also I think would resonate with many of us who are feeling like we're right smack in the middle of this time period in our life where we've got aging parents, kids to take care of, and what do we do? How do we manage the family history and the caretaking and doing the right thing? If you would like to join in the conversation and share your thoughts about that sandwich phenomenon or being a caretaker for someone who maybe you've got a little bit of history and baggage with but are eternally optimistic, as is Katie Hafner, the number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. It's certainly an experience a lot of people in the area are going through, and I think have a fair amount of experience and empathy with. So let's, I'm curious about what you say you were very optimistic about it, and your friends would say, golly, given your history, are you sure you want to do this? But is it something that you have friends they've done this, that you had seen people do it? What was your sort of community experience with it?
No, I did not have friends who did it, which is why they all said, what are you doing? And yet I did do some research, a little bit of research for the book into this, you know, multi-generational living phenomenon, which is interesting. It's actually on the rise. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
In fact, Architects are now designing homes within homes for this very
Recent studies are showing that the numbers are going up. Numbers are going up.
So what's interesting is that we're building the infrastructure for this to take place, but we're not really thinking through some of the more kind of emotional aspects of it and the psychological aspects of it. So people do ask me, you know, what should one think about before embarking on something like that? And I should point out that the counselor we went to actually specializes in helping people navigate this very thing, having elderly parents either move near you or in with you. And so there are all kinds of things, all sorts of landmines that you have to be careful of.
Was there an expectation when she moved in that it would be for this defined period of time that she would be on her own in a San Francisco apartment? Or were you really doing an experiment where you were going to see how it played out?
We were really doing an experiment to see how it would play out.
And did she see it that way?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, she had gone through something really rough with her living situation and her partner of many years who she'd been living with. And she really had to get out of Dodge. You really needed to leave San Diego, in my opinion. And so I really wanted her to build a new life for herself, which she did, which is amazing.
And she was not resentful or resistant to the idea that you would be caretaking. And did you even see it as your role as caretaking?
No. In fact, she was actually, except she'd had one knee replaced, the other knee needed to be replaced, and this carpal tunnel in her wrist. And otherwise, she, in great shape. I mean, she was having trouble climbing stairs with the bad knee. But no, there was really not much in the way of care. In fact, she really thrived. She got much better after she moved to San Francisco and was driving all over the city and learned how to parallel park, which actually it completely surprised me that she didn't know how to parallel park.
And what was so beautiful was that she seemed so open and wanting to make the changes.
Oh, yeah.
Her level of awareness about what your childhood had been seemed like her eyes all of a sudden opened.
Right. I mean, that was very tough.
Well, we're talking this hour with Katie Hafner about her new book, Mother, Daughter, Me. And we're going to take a short break, but if you'd like to join in the conversation or ask a question, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website at kqed.org/forum. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Krasny, and you are listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking with journalist and author Katie Hafner. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, has worked for Newsweek and Business Week and a myriad of other news outlets, and also the author of a few other books besides this new one, Mother, Daughter, Me. Earlier books include A Romance on Three Legs, Glenn Gould's Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Piano, and also a book on the history of the Internet called Where Wizards Stay Up Late. And if you'd like to see Katie Hafner, she will be on Thursday night at Point Reyes Books at 7 p.m. And on Sunday, August 18th, she'll be at Litquake in Palo Alto at 4:15. And you can find more information about these events on our website, kqed.org/forum. So again, on Thursday night at Point Reyes Books at 7 and on Sunday at Litquake in Palo Alto. And again, this book is a memoir, Mother, Daughter, Me, and recounts the story of her 77-year-old mom, Helen, who moved in with her from San Diego, joined her up in San Francisco, and Katie Hafner was in the midst of raising a teenage daughter and brought mom in, and family baggage ensued, but much progress was made. Let's talk a little bit about what we were talking about before the break. What's so interesting is, you know, the childhood was very tumultuous, and yet she seems, at least in the book, Helen seems to not quite recall it in the same way you do.
Yeah. Well, for her, it was a bit of a blur. Well, a big blur. And one thing about being the child of an alcoholic is that what the child remembers is remembered in granular detail. What the alcoholic remembers, the parent, is one big cognitive kind of blackout. And so we had some very heavy kind of, as you say, revelatory moments when she, when in this therapist's office where I told her my memory of what had happened, and she, to her great credit, looked at me and she said, "I am so sorry," because a lot of this she just didn't remember.
So, how did you react to that?
I was so grateful to her for expressing, contrition. And she took it very hard. And then she did another wonderful thing, which was I asked her if she would read this Judy Wallerstein book called The Legacy of Divorce, which is a longitudinal study of the effect of divorce on children over, I think, 25 years. And she did. She bought it on Amazon. She read it. She said she was actually, you know, sitting in bed, shaking, crying while she was reading it, understanding the impact that it had had, that the divorce had had on my sister and me, which was another really wonderful thing to her to do. So in addition to that, she then reinvented herself and created this wonderful new life for herself in San Francisco and made a lot of friends and was driving all over the city and taking continuing education for seniors. And
so it wasn't a one-sided story, really. It was as life is. There were a host of great things coming out of this experience.
Exactly. Oh,
and
exactly.
She was learning about a history that she really didn't quite recall.
Right.
Reinventing herself.
Right.
And you were tightroping between your daughter and mother, but eventually got to a place where she could move on out.
And the other really generous thing she did was start talking to my sister. They had had an on-again, off-again, and in recent years, very off-again relationship. And she just started talking to her. And my sister would call very often, and my mother would sit there very patiently and listen. And it was really a good thing.
Well, we've got a lot of callers on the line. We're talking this hour about three generations under one roof, an experience that a lot of people have had, especially that role of being in the middle, taking care of one's parents or helping out one's parents, and also taking care of one's child. And if it's an experience you have had in your back pocket, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Zoe, Katie's daughter, Helen, Katie's mom, and she all came to terms with a working situation. But it can be a bumpy road. It can be a bumpy road. Let's go to some of our callers. Claire is calling us from Oakland. Good morning, Claire.
Hi. I feel like this forum topic was made for me. About a year ago, my mother-in-law moved in with us, and at the time, my daughter was 1 year old, so she's two now. And She's the best mother-in-law I can hope for. She's a really wonderful woman. We have a great relationship. But all of that aside, it's really, really hard to incorporate another adult into an existing household.
There you go. And I think your line, all of that aside, is what everybody in the Bay Area is,
right,
is going.
How do you set all of that aside?
All of that aside.
Exactly. And it's for us, it's really about, you know, these are the rules of our household, and, you know, you have to call if you're going to be late for dinner, and all of that, like, that's not how I do it in my household. Well, you know what? You're not in your household anymore. It's this house now. And it's just little things like how you, it's just like stupid everyday stuff.
Well,
like,
have you noticed that your husband, I assume it's your husband's mom,
it's his
is
mother,
that right?
Yes.
Does he revert back to the parent-child relationship where he's in child mode?
Yeah, there's some ways in which, like, we just got back from this long road trip, and I woke up and I said, oh, I need some water. And she said, go over there. And so he went over there, and I'm like, there's no water over here. It's just kind of like, if she tells him to do something, he'll do it without even thinking about, like, the, you know, oh, well, actually, I was supposed to be getting my wife water, not soda.
Right. Is she going to stay, Claire, is she going to be staying with you guys in an ongoing way?
Well, you know, it's, when she first moved in with us, it was supposed to be like, okay, well, we'll see if this works. And she was going to get herself her own house. But she has fibromyalgia and she has a lot of health problems. And I was the one who actually said, you know, I just don't feel comfortable with her living on her own. I feel like, and she's very, very young to have such severe health problems. Mm-hmm. But I just wouldn't feel comfortable. Like, what if she has a fall and we're not there because she has that hip? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, thanks for calling in, Claire.
Yeah.
Thanks. I want to pursue that idea about the parent-child thing with you, Katie, for a minute. Was it odd for you to revert to daughter behavior, daughter bias, daughter patterns when you're the mom? So there you are with your daughter, and you're being the mom, and you're exerting a certain amount of authority and ownership of your life and your role. And yet patterns are what they are.
Right.
And
even
there we are in front of our kid acting like a teenager with our own parent.
Even if she didn't raise me after the age of 10, I still found myself reverting. And she noticed it too, which was interesting. And yet
Helen did.
Yeah. My mother. And who's Helen in the book. And we were both a little bit stunned by this. And then the things that play themselves out, that's really interesting what Claire said about her husband. It's just subconscious.
So it's a somewhat tricky question. Is alcoholism was a really driving force in the years when your mom was with you and your sister. And I'm wondering if that was hard for her, since we fall into patterns. And once she's in mom role again, was alcohol an issue?
No, not at all.
So she had moved completely through that.
She's completely through that. Yeah.
Good for her. We've got some listener responses online. Eric from Albany writes, I read Miss Hafner's book, but was left in suspense near the end, wondering if her mom is now in an assisted living facility. If so, how it's working out? And he'd be interested in hearing about your experiences looking for a suitable living spot for your mom once she'd been in that situation here in the very expensive Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. I go through this in the book, how incredibly expensive these kinds of retirement communities are in the Bay Area. It's just terrible, really just punishing costs. So we did look at a couple of places when she thought of when we decided she would move out. But then found a wonderful apartment for her. Which is where she is now in the city. And
she's built a whole community.
Yeah,
she's
built
doing
a whole
great.
Community.
All right. Cora writes, please tell Katie this is a great book, one which exposes how complex the ties between mothers and daughters can be and how these ties are foundational to all of us, often whether or not we want them to be. Cora's question is, how was Katie able to figure out what tools were necessary for becoming a good mom to your own daughter after the difficulties you encountered in your childhood?
That is such a good question. You know, there's this idea of, which I only learned about recently, it's called multi-generational trauma. And so the real challenge is breaking the cycle. And to tell you the truth, I honestly don't know how I knew to break the cycle or how to break it, except maybe through my mother-in-law, who was a big model for me, Denny, who lives in Texas now and was just a wonderful, wonderful mother to her sons. And I was close to her from the age of 10.
I wonder if that was tricky for your daughter, Zoe, because she, the grandmother she had known best was
Denny,
your husband's mom, Denny. And so she'd seen this kind of a hyper-fabulous grandmother role. I mean,
right.
It sounds like
uber-fabulous.
She's just, this insanely idyllic grandmother role. And then your interesting mom enters the picture with her very, you know, strong personality.
Right.
Different
right.
house of cards.
Very different, yeah. And I think that was hard for, in fact, in the book, there's a scene where Zoe and I go to visit Denny, and I think Zoe says something to me like, why can't Grandma Helen be more like Denny? And it's like, well, you know, sweetie, she is who she is. And, I think grandmothers, I had never thought of the grandmother versus grandmother dynamic.
Oh, competitive grandmothering? Oh, dear, that's a show in itself right there. Another listener writes, thank you, Katie, for this moving book. I loved it because it shows us what George Saunders speaks of in his 2013 commencement address, How to Be a Kinder Person. And for folks that haven't seen that, that's going around online and on Facebook. George Saunders delivered, a commencement address at Syracuse. Mm. That was beautiful. And the listener goes on to say, do you think people need to be as objectively and ruthlessly self-aware as you were with yourself in order to become a kinder person?
I have to say, that's a great question. I was not so ruthlessly aware of myself until the terrible incident in Trader Joe's with the lactaid, the cruelty around the lactaid.
But you talk about how you wouldn't answer questions, or you'd make her ask questions, or you'd let this stony
nasty
silence exist in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And that's very much what a teenager does with their parent. You know, it's, I'm not going to, yes, it's uncomfortable, and this is, but I'm feeling cranky.
Yeah, interesting. No, it wasn't a teenage response. It was more, I'm not going to give to you response. It was my way of withholding from her something she really wanted, which was just my attention.
All right, let's go back to the calls. We've got Anna calling from, do I have Anna or Razzie? Razzie calling from Mill Valley?
It's Robbie.
Hi there.
Hi. I am new in the experiment. I moved my mother in about 4 months ago, and I had known basically my entire adult life that I would be responsible for my mother. She has some health issues and is divorced. And I got married later in life, like a lot of people in the Bay Area do. So part of looking for a spouse was letting them know the situation that someday my mother would be moving in. Wow. So that obviously cleared the deck for quite a few.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. And did you have a full disclosure policy?
I did.
You have integrity.
I did. I don't believe in surprising people. And I'm half Indian and come from half of a culture that believes in taking care of the elderly and so forth. So I knew it was part of the game, and the right person for me would accept it. And
Well, you've got to fill us in now.
Right,
where are
right.
you in the process? Have you found
well,
a partner?
I married a wonderful man who thought long and hard about it and decided to take the plunge with me. We have a 6-year-old son. And we then proceeded to remodel our house because we have a tiny house and added on. And we did it a little more sanely in the sense that we were able to do an in-law unit. So we're not sharing the same kitchen, the same bathroom, and so forth.
That's key.
Which was really wonderful.
And are you, is your mom totally on board? Is it something where there's any, caretaker, you're not my caretaker, I'm independent? How are you figuring that one out?
It's a little tricky. All of us were on board. My husband, my mother, my son, we're all very excited about it. And with any house remodel, it takes time getting the situation set up. So we all saw it coming, but the first month or two was very rocky. So when she finally moved in, there was a lot of stress between both my mother and my husband. And they were both very open to it, the idea of it. But the reality, as you know, is a little different sometimes. So she moved in, and she was just anxious because she spends so much time at home because of her health issues. Moving her to a new environment basically reverted her to childlike behavior. And same thing with my husband, who's used to having his own space, even though she is in an in-law unit. So the first month or two was really, really tough. But we've found our equilibrium so far. And again, we're only 4 months into this.
All right. Well, Robbie, thanks and good luck.
Thank you so much. Okay,
bye-bye.
Katie Hafner?
Wow, I have to applaud Robbie on so many levels here, but one of them, and the full disclosure, obviously, but it gets to a central question of the book, which is, what is our obligation to our parents as they age? In my case, the question goes on, particularly if they were less than perfect parents when we were children. And I come down and I'm sure Robbie, and it sounds like she has a husband who comes down on this, you know, that we do what we can for our parents because they did the very best for us as parents, given what they have to work with. And that's sort of this mantra that I've...
Or they did the best they could in their own life story.
Yes, exactly.
And so you'd feel driven, and clearly Robbie does too. Anna in Oakland, good morning.
Good morning. I am Mexican, and I married an American citizen.
You married what?
A citizen from the United States.
Oh, an American citizen, uh-huh.
So my parents obviously are Mexican, and we have a very traditional way of, in Mexico, you take in your parents, of course, when they get old. So when my husband offered to try living with my parents to see if it would work out to live together, I immediately took the opportunity. And we tried it for 2 months. And what happened, every time I got home from work, my parents had so many requests of my time that I ended up really not interacting with my husband very much. And my husband decided that if my parents were to move in permanently with us, we would probably end up separating.
Right. So divided loyalties. This is something where I think, Anna, you're in good company because this sounds like whether it's between a husband and a parent who moves in or children and a parent, the person that's sandwiched in the middle really is wrestling with divided loyalties.
That's right.
And how did you kind of, I know it didn't, ultimately, it worked itself out because Helen moved on out into her own place. But it sounds like from these callers that we're getting that these first couple months are very, very tricky, very hard water to navigate, and maybe some ground rules or something needs
ground
to be
worked rules.
Out.
Ground rules. That's what I have been saying to people is make sure you've established ground rules before you move in together.
You went to a therapist, Leah, who specializes in this. And I think it's really interesting how in the book she referred to your situation right off the top without any hesitation as crisis.
As a crisis.
And I was sort of taken aback by that.
Right. I was too. And my mother certainly was taken aback. It's like, crisis? What do you mean crisis? And in fact, she said, Leah said, anytime something like this happens, it's a crisis. Because our culture, what's important to remember is that our American culture is not set up for this really in any way and hasn't been since the middle of the 20th century when...
Post-World War II, right.
Post-World War II, when it became this a sign of affluence to not have your parent living with you.
Well, and also it became the sign of adulthood to move on out and have your own home and have everybody in their own digs.
Right. And the sanctity of the nuclear family, not the extended family.
Let's go back to the calls. We've got Peter in Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I thought I could contribute relating a different kind of stuck. I was number 5 of 7 children in an alcoholic family. So, and I say family, maybe parents, you know, is where it begins, but it does infect the entire family. I was actually the only one that throughout my life never drank, but I became the identified patient. And also, having younger siblings, you feel responsible for your younger siblings, but you may not have any training or perspective of what to do.
So you're almost a sandwich child because you're taking care of sort of your family. You're in the middle of this bigger mix.
Right. And I understand from the experts that the children often feel like they have to really make up for all the dysfunction in the family because it would be so disastrous if the family fell apart. So they take on much, much too much responsibility emotionally and otherwise. And that can be a pattern that follows later in life.
How would you feel if you were in the position of needing to take in a parent at this point? After caretaking siblings and feeling like you were loaded down with the alcoholic parent scenario as a child,
Well, my parents are both passed on now, but I've actually done that in different ways. I mean, I helped my mother prepare the family house for sale, which took a tremendous amount of time. I've also kind of gone out of my way to help older people in two or three different occasions in my life. So if it's not your own parents, you may find others if you're of that ilk. But, you know, one other thing, somebody mentioned, what is our obligation to our parents as we grow up? One thing is to tell the truth if you have an opportunity. 2 years before he died, my dad had a moment with me on the basement stairs, you know, father-son type of thing. And he says, "We sure wish we knew," referring to his wife and my and himself, "we sure wish we knew where we went wrong with you." And a question, you know, like this, I'm a basket case. And my first response was, it was all silent, which was part of the family tradition. You just don't talk about this. The whole family was in denial that we had a problem with alcohol. But my first response was, "Hey, I'm not in a basket case. That's your idea." But the second one was alcohol. It just came up so clear in my mind. But my reaction was, it can't be that simple. It can't be that simple. But you know what? It was that simple, and I wish to this day that I had just said what came up in my mind and had that opportunity. I did have that opportunity. That was the moment, and I didn't grab it.
Well, that's a great point, Peter, that this idea of, to the question, what obligation do we have to our family members telling the truth? That's a powerful one. Maria in San Francisco, good morning.
Good morning. Talking about the truth, I think in my family it's the opposite. We talk about the truth too openly.
Truth can be overrated.
Yeah. My children I always felt a little sorry for because they have grown up in three cultures.
What are the three?
I come from Central Europe. My husband was from Central America, and they grew up here in San Francisco. So they had three cultures to assimilate into or try to live with.
All right. Of those three cultures, which is the most brazen truth-telling?
I think mine. when my child was, my last child was in her late 20s, she moved back in with a two-year-old daughter. And I kind of raised both of them again. And then she married once more and had another child who is still living here, who is now in her ninth year. And so it's like having a double duty for me and quite a different thing for her. I think it's very hard for her to be constantly in the same house that she was born in.
Sure, sure. Well, do you envision yourself ever in that situation where then you, given that you've been there in meeting that obligation to your daughter, that you would she would be available to take care of you when you get older?
Well, I am older, and I am 82, and she's in her 50s, early 50s. And I don't know how the caretaking would take place because I'm certainly hoping to stay healthy for a little bit longer.
Well, we hope so, too, and we'll keep in mind the Central Europeans are going to be truth-tellers. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the thing is that I came from a family that was broken up when I was very young. I was one and a half when my parents divorced. And I grew up within a very convoluted family situation with two stepmothers and a grandmother and an aunt and an uncle and everybody taking care of me on and off.
Mm.
And so my legacy is not very clear.
Right.
And I'm making my own rules in a way.
Well, good for you, Maria. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for calling in. And a listener writes, "I can't help but think of the hubris that this conversation entails. If you look at the rest of the world, families of limited means, or even the U.S. prior to the 1940s, most all homes are multigenerational. It's a waste of resources to have so many people living alone." And the last hour on climate change speaks to this. And that listener is right. We talked about that. This is a really new phenomenon.
Well, it's not. This is such a good point because we have the luxury. This is such a first world problem. I mean, we have the luxury of opting in or out of having multi-generational homes. And it is a lot of hubris at play. In fact, the reason that there are more multi-generational homes in the United States than there have been in years is for financial reasons, because of the bust.
Right. Another listener writes, while not having anything like your background, the mother-daughter issues resonated with me so much. When you were writing the book, were you aware of it being so universal, or were you trying for that?
You know, I knew that the sandwich generation was really a very universal problem, but I didn't realize how many buttons I was pushing.
We only have a couple of minutes left. Tell us a little bit of the end story. Now, I know your sister ended up dying, but the idea that your mom came to live with you sort of did tie it. It mm-hmm. did tie a bit of a bow around a very complicated family history.
And it was only in writing it that, you know, I'm lucky that I'm a writer, because I was able to sort of do that as a form of therapy and really put it to rest.
How did your daughter react to the idea that you were going to be writing this?
She said, yeah, whatever. And then the day the book came out, I got the nicest text from her. She said, I'm so proud of you, Mom, and I feel like the luckiest daughter in the world.
And what about Helen? How has she reacted?
I think she has struggled. I think it's hard. It's one thing to hold a mirror up to yourself and look in it voluntarily, and it's another thing entirely to ask someone to look in that mirror.
But she's not resisted it. I mean, it sounds like she's really come to the table.
Yeah, when I started the book, she said two things. She said, write whatever you want, and I won't read it. And she has read it since, and I think, as I said, I think it's been a struggle. I hope she understands. It's a love letter.
All right. Well, that is Katie Hafner. Her new book is called Mother, Daughter, Me. And Katie Hafner is a journalist who has written over the years for many outlets, including the New York Times, Newsweek, and Business Week. She also has a couple of other books under her belt, one being A Romance on Three Legs, Glenn Gould's Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Piano, which I think plays into your history of a piano in the family. And if you'd like to see Katie Hafner, she'll be on Thursday night at Point Reyes Books at 7 p.m. and this Sunday at Litquake in Palo Alto at 4:15, and you can find information about those events at kqed.org/forum. And thanks to all of the callers as well for joining us. Well, Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Amanda Stupai is the engagement producer for the show. Dan Zoll is the senior editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Engineering the show is Danny Bringer. I'm Penny Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.